Right, and we're in the fourth sermon in a series on disciple, and I want to read the whole of Matthew chapter 7, because last time, a couple of weeks ago, Marvellous Marvin was preaching on Matthew 6. Begins like this: "Do not judge, or you too will be judged. For in the same way as you judge others, you will be judged, and with the measure that you used, it will be measured to you. Why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye and pay no attention to the plank in your own? How can you say to your brother, 'Oh, let me take a speck out of your eye,' when all the time there's this steady great plank in your own eye? You hypocrites, first take the plank out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's. Do not give dogs what is sacred. Do not throw your pearls to pigs. If you do, they may trample them under their feet and then turn and tear you to pieces. Ask, and it will be given to you. Seek, and you will find. Knock, and the door will be opened to you. For everyone who asks receives, and he who seeks finds, and to him who knocks the door will be opened. For which of you, if his son asks for bread, would give him a fish? Or if he asks for a fish, would give him a snake?" Sorry, I got the first bit of that wrong, didn't I? "Which of you, if his son asks for bread, will give him a stone?" Nobody noticed it. "Or if he asks for a fish, will give him a snake. If you then, though you are evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Father in heaven give good gifts to those who ask him? So in everything, do to others what you would have them do to you. For this sums up the law and the prophets. Enter through the narrow gate. For wide is the gate and broad is the road that leads to destruction, and many enter through it. But small is the gate and narrow is the road that leads to life. Only a few find it. Watch out for false prophets, because they come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they're ferocious wolves. By their fruits you will recognize them. Do people pick grapes from thorn bushes or figs from thistles? Likewise, every good tree bears good fruit, but a bad tree bears bad fruit. A good tree cannot bear bad fruit. A bad tree cannot bear good fruit. For every tree that does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire. Thus, by their fruit, you will recognize them. And not everyone who says to me, 'Lord, Lord,' will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only he who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. Many will say to me in that day, 'Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name? And in your name did we not drive out demons and perform many miracles?' And I will tell them plainly, 'I never knew you. Away from me, you evildoers.' Therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and puts them into practice is like a wise man who built his house on the rock. And the rain came down and the streams rose and the wind blew and beat against that house. Yet it did not fall because it had its foundations on the rock. But everyone who hears these words of mine and does not put them into practice is like a foolish man who built his house on sand. And the rain came down and the streams rose and the winds blew and beat against that house. And it fell with a great crash." Well, we have reached number four in our series of sermons under the theme disciple. In the last one, a couple of weeks ago, Martin was exploring Matthew 6, which is the middle bit of the Sermon on the Mount, and he was preaching, apparently, about James Bond. And I wasn't here, but I understand that he left you all stirred but not shaken, which, of course, is not quite right for a sermon on 007. But I think the point that he was making was that underneath all the visible surface of our lives, there needs to be a whole secret hidden life in God. This week we're moving on to Matthew chapter 7, which consists of one big encouragement and several major warnings. It's a little bit of a sort of dark sermon in that sense, because it's a kind of reality check. And I want to begin with the encouragement, which is almost a postscript to what Jesus said in chapter 6 about prayer. And he says in verse 7 and 8, ask and it will be given to you, seek and you will find, knock and the door will be opened to you. For everyone who asks receives, he who seeks finds, and to him who knocks the door will be opened. We have a Heavenly Father who loves and cares about us, and we have unlimited access to him 24/7. Nobody can take that away from us. The most secret believers in the world, in places like North Korea, may not be able to go to church. They may not be able to speak about Christ, even to their children. They may know that even if they are seen closing their eyes in meditation, it may be enough to get them arrested in a place as toxic as North Korea, but they have this access to God that nobody in the world can take away. In fact, whoever we are and whatever our situation is, we have this sixfold invitation into the presence of God. When we come into the presence of God, our Father, in prayer, Jesus promises here three things. First of all, we will receive. God will not tick every item on our wish list. That isn't how prayer works. But when we pray, God gives. And verse 11 reminds us that if you, although you are evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Father in heaven give good gifts to those who ask him? How much more? God is longing to give good things into our lives. God works in our lives for good when we deliberately open ourselves and our situation up to him. It's one of the rewards of prayer. Secondly, we will discover. God will teach us things and open our minds to the mind of his Spirit. Over the years, I've found that my best ideas, my most anointed messages, my most creative thinking tend to come when I've invested time in the presence of God to pray and to listen. I hope that doesn't tell you too much about how much I pray. But I believe it's true. Thirdly, we will enter. The door is opened into our relationship with God. Because receiving things is great, and discovering truth is important, but above all, prayer is designed to bring us close to God, bring us into the heart of God. It isn't in the first place a way to get something else. It's not a means to an end, is prayer. It's its own reward. And there is nothing better than coming out of a time of prayer, knowing that the Lord has touched your hearts. I have to say, I would rather have that than almost any answer to a problem. So that's the big encouragement. Make the most of it, because the rest of this chapter is taken up with a whole series of warnings, because being a disciple, a real disciple of Jesus Christ, costs. It is not easy. And we need to hold on to both sides of that God's grace is a gift, but also there is a cost in discipleship. We need to hold on to the absolute grace of God and also to the challenges and the warnings that go with it. The great German pastor Dietrich Bonhoeffer put it this way. He said God's grace is free, but it isn't cheap. He was massively critical. He was a pastor in the 1930s in Germany. He was massively critical about his fellow German Christians because he thought they had no idea about the real cost of discipleship. They thought that it was enough that if you believed the right things, that you made a profession of faith, and then you lived how you'd always lived before. Bonhoeffer realized that God's grace is free because we can't earn it. But it is also costly because it means a commitment of our life to following Jesus. What is the cost of discipleship? Jesus gives, it seems to me, three main answers in this chapter. First of all, it is the cost of traveling the narrow road. Verse 13, enter through the narrow gate. For wide is the gate and broad is the road that leads to destruction, and many enter through it. But small is the gate, narrow is the road that leads to life, and only a few find it. I'll give you a rather trivial example of that. We live in Wales. It's a lovely part of the world. And I love Wales when it's not raining. I enjoy exploring the hills and the coastline, searching out some of the fantastic scenery of this magnificent part of the world. But if you stay with the crowds, if you follow everybody else up the M4, you will miss the best of this lovely country. I've discovered that most of the best stuff is off the beaten track. Often it involves picking your way carefully down ridiculously narrow half-track roads with grass growing up the middle of them, and you're wondering if you met somebody coming up the other way, how on earth you would cope, and how many hundreds of yards you have to back off before you actually find somewhere where you might be able to pass. And when you reach the beginning of the walk and you start walking, you can be going for a couple of hours or more without seeing another human being. It isn't easy, but it's rewarding. And what is true physically is also true spiritually. That the way to real life is not by following the crowds, going with the flow, sticking with the majority. That the broad road leads to snarl up. It leads to destruction. It is the narrow path which sometimes we will have to choose to walk on our own by ourselves that leads to life, and it can be costly. Bonhoeffer understood this. He lived in the 1930s, as I say. That was the time when Hitler came to power in Germany. And at first in Germany, Hitler was wildly popular. He made Germans feel good about themselves. He got industry going. He got the autobahns built. He seemed like a great success story. And an awful lot of German Christians were happy to drift along with everybody else in that. They ignored the fact that Adolf Hitler had a rather nasty anti-Semitic streak. They ignored the fact that he clearly had no time for human rights. They ignored the fact that he was acting and thinking as if he was God. They ignored the fact that he was committed to starting another world war. Bonhoeffer knew that as a Christian, he could not go with the flow. He could not turn a blind eye. He stood up against Hitler and the Nazi thugs, and in the end, he paid for his opposition with his life. But that's what discipleship means, that we bow our knee to the Lord Jesus Christ, and we refuse to go along with the crowds who are happy to worship at the altar of Nazism or materialism or consumerism or whatever else it may be. And the reality is that the great majority of us will not face imprisonment or death for our faith, but we still have that choice whether we're going to drift with the crowd around us or whether we're going to be true to the Lord and to ourselves and choose the less trodden road and go along God's path for our lives. There's a real cost in that. There's no getting away from it. Secondly, there is the cost of producing good fruit. Jesus talks about this in verses 15 to 18. Every good tree bears good fruit, but a bad tree bears bad fruit. A good tree cannot bear bad fruit, and a bad fruit cannot bear good fruit. Every tree that doesn't bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire. I found a few weeks ago a jar of homemade jam from early 2009. On the lid there was a lovely picture of strawberries, and I thought that was wonderful because strawberries are actually my favourite fruit, and I thought this is going to be fabulous. I tried it. It was not strawberry jam. The lid said it was, but the fruit inside said black currants. Thankfully, black currants are fine. So whoever gave us some blackcurrant jam 3.5 years ago, if it was you, thank you very much. It's very nice. We are enjoying it. But when it comes to being disciples of Jesus Christ, it is a lot easier for us to change the label on our lives than it is to change the reality or the fruit. And you and I can come to church and we can look like Christians, but the Lord's question to us is not what's on the label, but what's the fruit of our lives? What's the reality? Sometimes it will be obvious. I've been in churches with folks who have looked and sounded like disciples of Jesus Christ, but they've had obvious issues with anger and aggression that they showed no sign at all of wanting to deal with. I can say that at Woody because I'm not sure that we've got anyone like that here. But they thought it was okay just to throw their weight around and sound off at all and sundry. Sometimes the issues will be less obvious than that. You may do the whole happy, clappy, worship the Lord thing on a Sunday morning, but be drinking yourself under the table on a Wednesday night. You may have issues with laziness or with internet porn that nobody else knows about. You may be involved in a sexual relationship which is not right. You may have a dysfunctional approach to relationships that only your family can see. Sometimes we actually need our wives, our husbands, our children even, to speak uncomfortable truths about our lives so that we recognize for ourselves areas where the reality of our discipleship is not quite what it says on the tin. But you see, God isn't interested in what it says on the label. He's interested in what's inside. Now, hear me clearly this morning, because if you have issues of sin in your life that you're struggling with, I am not playing the guilt card. I'm not playing the guilt card. We've all got those battles. None of us is the finished article. We are all works in progress. And if you're sitting there this morning feeling a failure, I don't want to add one tiny little milligram to the weight of that on you. I'm not condemning anyone who's struggling in their Christian life, not at all. But if there are things in our lives that are wrong and we're not acknowledged them, and we're not committed to putting them right with God's help, then to that degree we are not genuine disciples of Jesus Christ. Because the question that he asks is always about the fruit in the jar, not about the label on the lid. It is about what sort of fruit we're producing. There is a cost in being honest with ourselves, with each other, with God, and dealing with reality in our lives. Verses 21 to 23 continue that theme with a couple of rather specific warnings. The first is, don't be overimpressed by words. Verse 21 says, not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only he who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. Now, it may be that what I'm going to say here is controversial, and if it is, then, forget it. But we live in a culture where it seems to me you live or you die by the sound bites. It's all about words. An example of that. It seems to me that it takes something rather special for a government minister to lose his job in this country. You can take Britain into an illegal, unnecessary and pointless war in Iraq, and you can keep your job. You can preside over rail franchise bids that are so incompetent that you've wasted £40 million of the nation's money. You can set up criminally irresponsible PFIs in times of plenty to build hospitals and schools that the nation will pay for twice in times of austerity down the line. You can make extraordinary blunders in government and keep your job, but on the 25th of October, Andrew Mitchell, the government chief whip, lost his job because in 10 seconds of bad temper, he swore at a policeman in Downing Street. Now, I don't, of course, defend what he said. It was clearly wrong, and he knew that it was wrong. But I wonder, am I the only person who thinks it's slightly odd that one rude comment to one individual is so much more important than years and years of costly incompetence and dubious truthfulness? You know? Words. We seem incredibly impressed by the soundbite in our culture. It gets quoted back over and over, good or bad. God is not so impressed by what we say. Jesus told a parable in Matthew chapter 21, verse 28. He says, what do you think? There was a man who had two sons. He went to the first and said, son, go and work today in the vineyard. And he answered, I'm not going to do that. But later on, he changed his mind and went. Then the father went to the other son and said the same thing. He answered, yes, sir, I will. But he didn't go. Which of the two did what his father wanted? The answer that they gave, which was the right answer, was the first one. It wasn't the words, it was the reality. It was the action that mattered. Don't get overhung up about sounding good. God is not impressed. What he looks at is our heart and our life. And the second warning here specifically is don't get too impressed by ministries and charismatic gifts. Now, I don't know about you, but I find Jesus' words in verses 22 to 23 quite shocking. This is what he says. Many will say to me on that day, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name? In your name, didn't we drive out demons and perform many miracles? And I will tell them plainly, I never knew you. Away from me, you evildoers. We're talking here about spirit-filled Christians. They prophesy. They drive out demons. They heal the sick. They do crusades. They perform miracles. They speak in tongues. They do the flipping works. They are involved in ministries. They're deacons. They're street pastors. They're Sunday school teachers. They're evangelists. And the day will come when Jesus looks at them and he says, I never knew you. You know, we never really shared a relationship together. Jesus says that if we are not committed to doing the will of his Father, you and I can have any amount of spiritual manifestations in our lives, but there will not be genuine relationship between him and us. We can say the right words, we can enjoy spiritual experiences, we can use spiritual gifts, we can be involved in spiritual ministries, but if we're not committed to living by the word of Christ and under his authority, Jesus says there is no real relationship between us and him. Now, I think that's a real shot across the bows, isn't it? The third cost is the cost of building strong foundations. In verses 24 to 27, you've got this well-known story of the two houses. One of them is a fairly lazy builder. He finds this area which is nice and easy to build on. He gets his house up and in no time built on the sand. The other guy builds foundations into the rock and it takes him three times as long. Jesus hearers would have recognized the scenario here because Israel is a very dry country and most of the time it doesn't rain. And so most of the time you've got two kinds of terrain. You've got rocky ground where it's difficult to build anything. And you've got sandy, dried up riverbeds that seem an awful lot easier. But don't be fooled, because every now and again the rains will come. When they do, the water will run down off the rocks. It will bounce down off the hillsides. It will bounce up off the hard ground. And it will all end up in these dried up sandy riverbeds. An absolute torrent of water rushing, gushing through. And it will sweep away everything in its path. Those are the two places that Jesus is talking about the houses being built. Now look at these two guys. Both of them are hearers of Jesus' message. Everyone that Jesus is speaking to here in Matthew chapter 7 is someone who's chosen to climb up the mountain to listen to him. They are believers. They are, if you like, Bible students. So what's the difference? One of them faces the cost of building his Christian life on the foundation of real obedience. He hears what Jesus says. He takes it to heart. He builds his life on it. He lives out of it. The other one hears, maybe even studies. He enjoys the whole Christian thing. But he never faces up to the cost of letting the gospel of Jesus change and shape his life. Jesus says that spells disaster. The only safety that we have is in the center of the will of God for our lives. The only safety that we have is letting Jesus shape who we are, how we relate to others, how we deal with their ambitions and our values, and putting everything under the lordship of Jesus Christ. The only safety that we have is in the reality, not just the appearance or the rhetoric, but the reality of being a disciple of Christ. And I know this morning has been a little bit of a slap around the face with a wet kipper. It's that sort of a message. The title that I had was Reality Check. Because our following of Jesus has to be real. Otherwise, we're not disciples. There are dangers in being skin deep. good weather disciples. But there are huge rewards in being the real thing. Jesus highlights three, and I'll highlight them and say almost nothing about them. First of all, from a life of genuine discipleship come results. From a good tree will come good fruits. From a life that is genuinely built on Christ will come a character that glorifies God and a ministry that exalts Jesus. Jesus said to his disciples in John chapter 15, "You didn't choose me, but I chose you that you would go and bear fruit, fruit that will last." There's that promise that comes from real discipleship. Secondly, he promises relationship. We will know Christ. We won't be amongst those who Jesus turns around to and says, "I don't think I ever really knew you." He'll be those who says, "My friend, come." And in that relationship, we will find reward and fulfillment that lasts beyond anything else in the world. And the third thing that will arise from real discipleship is resilience. Resilience, because in all of our lives, the storms will come. Things will happen that will shake us. Now, in 3 weeks' time, Josh is going to be preaching about how Jesus built faith into the 12 and how he builds faith into our lives. It'll be a cracking sermon. It'll be good, encouraging stuff. I hope it will raise our expectations of how God can work in our lives. But make no mistake, whatever faith we've got, however we see God working in our lives, there will come a time in your life, if it hasn't come already, when you face storms that threaten to blow you away and drown your faith, when seriously difficult things happen to you. It may be that you lose your job. It may be that you don't manage to find a marriage partner. It may be that your child goes off the rails. It may be that you face the loss of someone that you love. Maybe that you face persecution or illness. It may be that amongst all the good things that you can see God doing around you, you face a very major prayer that God doesn't seem to be answering. And if your faith has been just words, if it's just been skin deep, if it's just been this nice easy drift with the crowds, you will fall. Ultimately, you will fall with your faith. If your life has been built on Jesus Christ, reshaping your life and patterning it according to his will, the storm will come, but it need not destroy you. My title this morning was Reality Check, and that's how I want us to encourage us to take this morning. Socrates, the Greek philosopher, said, "The unexamined life is not worth living." The very beginning of Matthew chapter 7 is actually saying something very similar. It's an invitation to look at ourselves and make that reality check. You could reach verse 1 and think that it was not about making any sort of assessments about any right or wrong. Do not judge or you too will be judged. That isn't what it's saying. You only need to revert through to verse 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 to realize that that is not what it's saying. What it's saying is the spotlight is not for us to shine out on other people. It is for us to shine first and foremost on ourselves. Why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye and pay no attention to this dirty great plank in your own? How can you say to your brother, "Oh, let me take the speck out of your eye," when all the time that plank is there in yours? You hypocrite, first take the plank out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye. We're coming to communion. And the Apostle Paul says in 1 Corinthians chapter 11 and 28 that as we come preparing to share bread and wine together, it is right for us to examine ourselves. We're not examining ourselves to see if we're perfect. There's no need to do that because I can tell you already, none of us is. We're looking to see if we're honest, if we're real about Jesus being Lord of our lives. Is there stuff in our past that we've not confessed? Is there stuff in our present that we have not wholly surrendered to the Lord? Is there stuff in our future that we are not yet trusting God for? And I want to invite us just to ask the Lord to shine his light on our hearts, maybe using the words of Psalm 139. Search my heart, know my thoughts, know my anxious thoughts. See if there is any offensive way in me. And as we come into communion, I want to suggest that we do so just by through a short time of silence, when we say to God, God, show me my heart. Show me my blind spots. Father, bring home to me places where my discipleship is about words which are not reflected in my life. Lord God, speak to me so that I would be with authenticity, somebody who hears and looks to do your word, looks to build on your purpose for my life. God, as we come to share this amazing gift, when you gave yourself, when you poured out your life for us, when you had your body broken for us and your blood shed on the cross to rescue us from our sin. God, as we come to that time, Father, would you examine our hearts and speak to us about stuff that needs changing?